ignoring the people of his state. Won't listen, won't bargain, won't negotiate. That's why there's 14 senators sneaking across the border. 14 senators, capital disorder. 14 senators, new Wisconsin heroes. What's the score? Senators 14, Governor Walker 0. Protests are growing.
Well, good morning, everyone. Yes, this is the Sarah Schultz Show. You are tuned in, and I am obviously not Sarah Schultz. I am Bill Dovey, guest hosting for Sarah today, who is involved with family business that has taken her away from her studio. There is no concern, though, as Sarah is engaged in happy family business. I do want to add that today, Saturday, September 24th, is the last Saturday on which the Sarah Schultz Show will be broadcast, as the Sarah Schultz Show is moving to a new day and time. The Sarah Schultz Show, starting next Friday, September 30th, will now be on Fridays from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. Also, Sarah usually starts the show with the Defend Wisconsin Weekly News Roundup presented by Yuri Rashkin. However, Yuri is on vacation, so he will not be on today. However, Yuri will be back for Sarah's first Friday show on September 30th. So I would like to remind everyone that you can hear the Sarah Schultz Show tonight from 6 to 8 p.m. on the low power FM station Citywide 99.1 FM in Madison, Wisconsin. I believe this morning's show will be broadcast on Citywide 99.1 FM next Saturday from 6 to 8 p.m. First, I have a few announcements. The first announcement is that the Oregon Area Progressives will be holding a forum on ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, in Fitchburg, Wisconsin, on October 22, 2011. The location is 5445 East Sherrill Parkway from 8:30 a.m. through 4:30 p.m. Secondly, the Media Action Center is on their 2011 Wisconsin Media Reform Tour, visiting 8 cities between September 17th through the 27th. I would direct your attention to their website at www.mediaactioncenter.net. And Media Action Center is all one word. Now on to our first guest. And let me see if I can go ahead and get her on here. And there we go. Our first guest is going to be Representative Christine Sinicki, representing the 20th Assembly District. She is a Democrat, and her district covers the cities of Cudahy, St. Francis, and portions of the southeast area of the city of Milwaukee. Christine was born in Milwaukee, is married, and has two children. She is a graduate of the Bayview High School, and she is a former small business manager. She has an impressive membership list. She was elected to the Assembly in 1998, reelected since 2000. She's been on the Minority Caucus as a secretary in 2001. She's State Assembly Milwaukee Caucus as the State Assembly in Milwaukee. She's been part of the Department of Workforce Development State Minimum Wage Council as a governor's appointee. And she was on the Milwaukee School Board from 1991 through 1998. She's been on the Wisconsin Coalition Against Domestic Violence, the Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs, where she has received certificates of commendation in 2005 and 2006. And she's a Professional Firefighters of Wisconsin Legislator of the Year for 2010. Wisconsin Grocers Association Friend of Grocers in 2010, and the Cudahy Veteran Service Award from 2010. Her most impressive list continues on, but time purposes, I'm not going to read everything. So nonetheless, Representative Sinicki, thank you for coming on the show. And have I missed anything, or is there something else you'd like to add to that?
No, every time somebody reads something like that about me, I feel so old. It's like, Where did I have time to do all that? But thank you for having me on, and thank you for continuing to keep this the issues of labor alive for us.
You are more than welcome. So anyway, what we would like to address today is, and with you being on the Sarah Schultz Show, is to primarily discuss the Republican war on labor and the challenges facing labor. So, madam, the floor is yours.
Well, as you all know, it's been a, you know, kind of a rough couple of months for the labor movement. First, I want to thank everybody who really, you know, came out to the Capitol at the protest. That's what really kept the Assembly Democratic Caucus going. We really appreciate everybody's help and support in this. You know, Friday was the deadline for the unions to recertify, and many of the unions chose not to recertify at this point because they just didn't think it was worth the trouble of doing it.
Because some people view that as probably an ominous situation that the unions, because they did not recertify, are withdrawing due to Republican pressure, or perhaps Republicans viewing that they have achieved their goals in suppressing union activity.
Well, you know, yes, I think they may be withdrawing a little bit, but I also think they're regrouping. I strongly believe that with the support and help of the people in the state of Wisconsin, 2012, we're going to get the majority back, and we're going to give the people back their rights to negotiate.
Oh, great.
So, I mean, that's my goal. So, I don't believe the labor movement is dead in the state of Wisconsin. I think we're going to rebuild it, and it's going to come back stronger than ever. You know, I've talked with many union leaders who just feel very strongly that their members do need to get active for the 2012 elections. And we look forward to working with everybody to you know, reach our goals. So, I don't know what else you want.
In this process, could you also just address the tactics that Governor Walker, the Assembly leader and the Senate majority leader, the Fitzgerald brothers, what they have done to work in concert to suppress union voter activity, any of those items that you feel that are very worthwhile to address?
Well, you know, first of all, I guess when you talk about the war on workers' rights, there's one issue here that a lot of people have not talked about, and what they wanted to do and what they're trying to do is get at the base supporters of the Democratic Party, which is labor. Now, I predicted the day after Walker was elected that we would be looking at becoming a right-to-work state. And the tactics.
I'm sorry to interrupt. And
sure.
Right-to-work state is a misnomer, if you wouldn't mind describing that.
Oh, yeah. Right-to-work is basically, you know, a union-killing tactic. I call it fire at will because right-to-work states, workers have absolutely no rights, no negotiating power, no unions to back them up, and it's a very anti-union attitude. That's why I call it fire at will, because you can be fired for any little thing, and you have no recourse. So, anyhow, so I predicted this was going to happen. Walker and the Republican caucus in both houses did nothing but lie to the people of Wisconsin. I have equated this to, I don't know if you're familiar with the Bayview tragedy, which is where the fight for the eight-hour day took place back in the 1800s, where Governor Rusk called out the militia to fire upon the workers.
Yes.
Eight workers were killed. Walker pretty much did the same thing. Instead of talking to the unions and sitting down at the negotiating table, he chose to call in the National Guard right away because he knew what he was doing was wrong and people were going to get fired up about it. He claims that he made offers to the unions, which he never did. Every major public employee union agreed to concessions early on in this whole process. Walker chose to ignore them. And that's not the way government in this state works. That's not the way democracy works. When the 14 senators left for Illinois, they did not leave because they were trying to avoid the issue. Everybody knows they left so that the people in the state could have a better understanding as to what the Republicans were about to do to them. And, you know, the Assembly Democratic Caucus could have thrown the towel in at any time because we knew we weren't going to win this battle. But we felt so strongly that we had to stay and fight this for the people, the working people in this state, and let the truth get out there. They have put out lies about the protesters. They have put out lies about the Democrats. You know, every day that we're in session, there's at least 5 or 6 arrests, people in the galleries. Because if someone looks at a Republican the wrong way now, they call the police. It is so out of hand, and it's almost depressing to go to work nowadays.
Yes, do you have and a... go ahead, I'm sorry. Continue.
I just got to put this in. I love the Capitol Singers at noon. I've joined them down there. They are great, to keep this momentum going. So
in your discussions with other assembly personnel, where do you see the challenges going as far as labor is concerned in the state of Wisconsin? Do you see the potential for collective bargaining to be to get back on the table should a Democratic Senate and Assembly reassert itself?
Oh, definitely. Like I said, 2012, I would hope we're going to flip both houses. And, I'm not going to say if there's going to be a recall or not, because I don't know. That's up to the people of the state of Wisconsin. But there's a possibility we could take back the governor's office. And you better believe once that happens, the first thing on the table is going to be to restore the rights of working people. I believe all the Democrats in the legislature feel very strongly about that. You know, state of Wisconsin has a long history of working with labor. And what they did was they wiped out 50 years of history in one vote. And I'm very confident that we're going to restore that.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
So, you know, it's just going to take people getting out and voting in 2012 and getting out there and working for Democratic candidates. I think, you know, 2010, I know teachers and public employees that voted for Walker in 2010. And they got quite an eye-opener. And many of them now are kicking themselves. I was talking to one teacher friend of mine who said, I can't believe he did this. And I said, well, wait a minute. If I recall, you had a Scott Walker sign in your front yard.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, we predicted this would happen, but you still supported Walker. I said, you got it. You know, you asked for it, you got it. Now we need to turn this around. So people really woke up and understand what Walker is about. He's not about the working class people in this state. In fact, you know, when we passed the budget, Speaker Fitzgerald gave his little budget speech. And in his speech, now I can't remember the exact quote, but what he basically said was, we have 27 new freshmen in our caucus, and each one of them came here knowing that they could be one term because they were going to take votes that were not going to make people happy. So they came into the legislature knowing that they were not doing the will of the people. They came into the legislature knowing that they were about to trash the state of Wisconsin, and they're proud of it. So I can't understand how they look themselves in the mirror.
Well, if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to go back to the comment that you made about the teacher who was in the teachers' union, who voted for Walker. And I think this is one of the great eyebrow-raising activities that a lot of union people did vote for, not only Walker, but a lot of the other Republican legislators. In retrospect, do you have a sense as to why they had done that versus voting for Democrats who traditionally were union or labor supporters?
Well, I can only speak to what I think happened in Milwaukee County. 41% of union households voted Republican. And my feeling is because Milwaukee County has the largest public employee union, most of those county employees wanted to see Scott Walker out of county government. That's my own
philosophy. So they decided to pass him on to the state?
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you so much. We really appreciate it. You know, and I think people in 2010 were for some reason looking for change. They thought this change would be better. And I think now they see that they were wrong. I go through my district, and, I mean, there are so many recall Walker signs and so many solidarity signs in my district that I just have a really good feeling that 2012 is going to be good for us.
Well, that's very encouraging.
Yeah, yeah, it is. You know, I think we're getting a lot of the independents coming our way, too, because people are so disgusted with partisanship and the infighting that they see people are getting really fed up with it, and it's time to change things.
Do you have a sense that perhaps this whole collective bargaining elimination was part of the Republican plan, not even so much as far as from Walker himself, but through Alex's allies in the Wisconsin State Legislature vis-a-vis Assemblyman Robin Voss and others?
Oh, definitely. They are taking their legislation straight out of Alex's playbook. There's no doubt about it. In fact, I actually posted Alex's agenda on my Facebook page a while back. And when you look at it, it's Bill for Bill is identical to what Alec is pushing. And if you look what's happening around the country, it's the same type of bills coming out of all the state legislators. So they are definitely, you know, playing Alec's game, and, you know, it's unfortunate that they can't come up with ideas of their own.
And that is the most depressing aspect of how our state government has turned.
Right.
That individuals that we have elected to represent us, regardless of whether or not we agree or disagree with them, that they have turned to an outside source and perhaps force to engage legislative activities. And this becomes a mockery of democracy by just being the sole person to vote for those policies, where given how a lot of these legislators have presented themselves in the media, regardless if the media was friendly to them or not, have demonstrated almost an incapacity to even come up with any kind of policy. And it makes me wonder how they even got elected.
You're absolutely right. You know, when I have bill ideas, my bill ideas usually come from the people in my district that have called me about an issue. And that's the way a legislature should work. There are a couple of Democratic think tanks out there, but nothing like Alec. I mean, Alec is such a powerful force. And, you know, like I said earlier, this whole thing was getting at to get at the base of the Democratic Party. They've done that, and now they're going to move forward their ALEC agenda. And I think that the rest of the session is going to be just as ugly as the first half. There's already a movement to repeal equal pay in the state of Wisconsin, which was a bill I worked on for 10 years. And in one vote, they're going to wipe it out. So, you know, it's going to be – the rest of the session is going to be just as ugly, and I think we have to be ready for it. So,
are we ready for it?
Well, you know what? The Assembly Democrats are going to stand strong. Our caucus is very united on these issues, and, you know, we're going to do our best to fight it back. But once again, we're going to need the people in this state to stand behind us and help us. You know, people need to call their Republican legislators and voice their opinion.
Well, that's an interesting point because I know many people, and I just don't throw the term many out just willy-nilly, but a significant number of people who have contacted their Republican legislators and are appalled at how their Republican legislators either don't respond to them or basically whether they respond to them, whether or not they call their offices, they have a very canned response for most people. And in many instances, Republican legislators don't return letters, emails, etc. And so it seems that they have been insulating themselves from the general public. And what I also have found fascinating over the evolution of the past, 5-6 months from I can't do math right now, since February, is that how the Republicans as a whole view their constituents and the greater constituency of the state of Wisconsin as something to run and hide from. And it's almost as though they have this great fear that they're going to be tar and feathered, where that could not be further from the truth, because having been involved with the 120,000 plus people on various occasions at the square, the reports that have come out that have vilified those large gatherings are so erroneous and egregious that that's all that it warrants any further, it doesn't warrant any further commentary. But while there may have been some shouting, these crowds were extremely respectful, and for some assembly personnel and state senators for that matter as well, to call these people thugs really speaks to the greater issue of how these Republicans view their role in government, whether it's from the local level up through the state legislature and for that matter, the way that the field is now, even into the U.S. Congress and Senate.
You're absolutely right. You know, I think a key to all this with the Republicans was the simple fact that they would not even walk the hallways without police protection. They knew they were wrong, and they are trying to cover it up by, you know, basically, like you said, vilifying all the protesters. And I just lost my train of thought.
so blank. No, that's fine, because then that gives me an opportunity to jump in with this then. Part of the problem, again, from being located in an area that's midway between Madison and Milwaukee, is I get to see both media, both general media outlets from both Milwaukee and Madison.
Uh-huh.
And I'm really surprised as to how the Milwaukee media in particular did not vet Scott Walker in his run for governor. I don't understand what it was that they thought he was going to get for them in the greater sense of how they operate. And even the coverage for the protest protests and larger assemblies that were at the Capitol, I found the usual suspects in the Milwaukee media, their coverage lacking and actually quite biased to being right of center.
Right, I agree. It was,
and in part,
the
think they're accountable. I think the Milwaukee media and other media outlets throughout the state are accountable for what has happened in this state. They have not done their job properly, and then to go ahead and say that it winds up being the fault of pointing the finger at a certain portion of the state electorate is really, again, a gross misnomer, and again is also just very egregious as to how they can shirk their responsibility after having allowed what appears to be people who really, in another time, would have been laughed out of their own communities.
Right. You know, as far as Scott Walker and the media, you know, what I have found is Scott Walker seems to be like Teflon. Nothing seems to stick to him. It all just kind of slides off of him. And everybody, the media all seem, you know, they all give him a pass. Look at what happened with that fake phone call from the Koch brothers. I mean, that should have been almost scandalous, the stuff that was said in that phone call. But yet it was just all glossed over. And, you know, when he was with the county, there was an issue where he hired somebody to work in human resources, and that person stole identities. That got a little tiny snippet in the paper. But again, it just kind of slid right off of him. I can't understand why Scott Walker keeps getting away with this stuff. Why is the media not being harder on him? To me, it's unfathomable. I cannot understand why they keep giving him these passes.
Well, and that's the $64 million question that many people are asking as to
right. How
we got this way, because of not only print media in Wisconsin, but the local television and radio stations as well.
Right. It's, you know, anybody else, this would have been a huge scandal, some of the stuff that he's been involved in. But, again, it just slides right off of him. And, I just can't figure out if he bought somebody off or what it is.
Sure. Well, let me bring this back in the closing time that we have remaining. I'd like to come back to your district. Correct me if I'm wrong, but your district historically, and I certainly don't know how it has been for the last 15 years, but having some awareness of Wisconsin and Milwaukee's south side, it appears that your district has historically been a blue-collar working class area. And
right. Do
you get a very strong sense that people have voters' remorse?
Oh, definitely. When I go out there and talk to people in my district, and people are more than willing to say, you know, I voted for Scott Walker, and I don't know why I did it. I will never do it again. I've got family members that are public employees that voted for Scott Walker, and they were out there at the protests. You know, I think there are now people that really weren't paying attention that will now start paying attention and will think twice before they vote Republican.
Interesting.
My district was really built on the backs of labor. I mean, and I'm very confident that Scott Walker would never win my district again.
Well, that's encouraging to hear. So in our last few minutes, is there any plugs or any additional comments that you would like to make?
And actually, I remember what I was going to say before when I lost my train of thought.
Sure.
During the protests and when people were trying to get a hold of Republican legislators and they weren't taking calls,
yes. We
figured out that if you call a Democratic office and ask them to transfer you through to your Republican legislator, they will pick it up because they think the phone call is coming from inside the building. So So I would encourage anybody, if your Republican legislator will not take your calls, call my office and ask to be transferred over. Because then on their caller ID, it looks like it's coming from inside the building, and they will pick up the phone.
Well, that's great advice.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm sure they don't appreciate it.
Sure. Well, hey, that's part of the political process.
Yep.
But on that note, I really appreciate you coming on this morning. Thank you very much. You're more than welcome to appear again. And
well, thank you,
you have a great day.
You too.
Thanks again. That was Representative Christine Sinicki from the 20th Assembly District in Wisconsin. We'll be right back after a break, and then at that time, we will come on with Mr. Scott Witkoff.
Won't take it, said a voice out loud. No, we won't take it, we will stand our ground. No, we won't take it, said a voice from the crowd. No, you won't pass a policy that holds us down. No, sir, no. No is our decision.
I'm sorry, everybody. That was just a bit of a technical difficulty on my part. But apparently you didn't hear this, but let me repeat it. So our next guest is Mr. Scott Witkoff. He publishes the blog Badger Democracy, Blogging in Black, Progressive Truth for One State and One Nation Controlled by Corporate Media. You can access Mr. Witkoff's blog at badgerdemocracy.com or bdgrdemocracy.wordpress.com. Scott is on the show today to comment on the recent FBI raid on the home of an aide to Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. Since this show has listeners from beyond the Wisconsin borders, I would ask Scott to provide some background on this raid, which I will assume is related to the ongoing John Doe investigation of the governor. So, Scott, is there anything you would like to add before we begin?
Not at all. That's perfect, and thanks for having me on the show this morning.
You're more than welcome, sir.
Well, I think we need to start, if you will, at the beginning. Last year, in May, Darlene Wink, who was one of Walker's aides when he was county executive in Milwaukee, resigned suddenly after an investigation into her sending emails and posting comments on, for one, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel webpage that were responding to critiques of then County Executive Walker. She was using a pseudonym to post those comments, and it was kind of one of those, it's something that she's doing on county time, on a county computer, but, you know, something that people really didn't care about. She quit, she resigned, end of story. A few months later, Tim Russell, who was the Milwaukee County Housing Administrator under Scott Walker, in August, his computer was actually seized. The hard drive was taken for analysis. And this was all part of this John Doe investigation that had started last year. If any of the listeners remember William Gardner from the Wisconsin and Southern Railroad Company, who was convicted of felony campaign abuse charges, fined very heavily. He was the first person who was actually convicted under this investigation. So going back to Russell, who in August had his computer seized, well, his employment ended with accusations of cronyism, political favoritism. He was Walker's assistant chief of staff behind Tom Nardelli. He was the Milwaukee campaign manager for Tommy Thompson when Thompson was running for governor. He was treasurer for the Milwaukee County GOP. And so at this point, Russell he's out of a job. He's in dire straits as a result of the fallout of this investigation. So that's two players in the Walker administration from when he was county executive. We also have information that Tom Nardelli, who was Walker's chief of staff as county executive, former alderman, had received a $90,000 a year job in the State Division of Environmental and Regulatory Services, which kind of has fallen under that reorganized, restructured Department of Commerce. And interestingly enough, earlier this year, Nardelli suddenly left that position, resigned, with virtually no notice. He's basically lawyered up. He's not commenting on the investigation. He's seems to be implicated by association with the Walker administration from his time as county executive. And there's also questions arising over whether the Walker administration, when they left Milwaukee County, has properly preserved records as required by law, that report coming from the Journal Sentinel. So there's three key players that earlier this year kind of started getting closer and closer to Scott Walker as this John Doe investigation moved forward. And then, of course, with the conviction of William Gardner, with the railroad kind of pay-for-play thing, gives us an indication of what this investigation is looking at.
Can I interrupt?
Sure, absolutely, yes.
So with the conviction of Bill Gardner, he's the chairman of the Wisconsin Southern Railroad?
Yes.
Was this a slap on the hand for him, or this was just a perhaps an indication that the opposition or Walker's forces needed to go further underground? Do you think they were affected by that conviction at all?
Well, I think it sent some people scurrying. I think that's why you saw the Nardelli resignation, because when that happened, that was a signal that this investigation was getting serious. You know, whether or not it's a slap on the hand, it's a pretty hefty fine. He can't participate in state politics for a number of years. There's kind of a probationary period for him. So whether it was a slap on the hand or a significant penalty, I think it sent more of a signal that this investigation is serious, and there are some serious things that it's looking at.
Okay.
I don't know. You know, I know you saw the story about the individuals granted immunity, which we can get to in more detail, you know, soon. But Ken Lucht, I'm not sure how the pronunciation of his name, he's one of the people granted immunity in this investigation, and he is the sole lobbyist registered with the state of Wisconsin for the Wisconsin and Southern Railroad. So this investigation has been looking at these things for a long time. So I think it's more accurate to say that it really sent people scurrying, and then we kind of get to Cynthia Archer.
And before we do that,
sure.
Again, going back to the Gardner conviction, do you have any knowledge or sense as to what role the Wisconsin State Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen's office or he personally had in that investigation of Gardner?
Well, J.B. Van Hollen has declined to participate in this John Doe investigation, which is really interesting. There were two statements that came out earlier this week.
And if I may,
first,
when you say he has declined to participate, he personally or his office? The office
well,
of the
office,
Attorney General. Okay.
The office of the Attorney General. But we have to make the connection that based on the fact that J.B. Van Hollen is a staunch Scott Walker supporter and a Republican, the politicization of his office runs very deep. So his office has declined to participate. They were asked to cooperate. They declined. J.B. Van Hollen himself, after that statement, came out with a statement saying that he and the Milwaukee County District Attorney's Office had reached a mutual agreement for him not to participate. And I honestly don't buy that. I do not buy that D.A. Chisholm in Milwaukee County, that was something mutual. I seriously believe that the Attorney General's office declined to participate for political purposes.
And so with that
–
go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say that that very much had a lot to do with Milwaukee County needing to turn to the FBI.
And I was just going to ask that. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, sure. Because of the technical nature of going through computer hard drives, analyzing information, analyzing data, things like that, tracking emails, that's an FBI thing. That's resources that Milwaukee County most likely would not have readily at their disposal. The state of Wisconsin would through the the DCI, but Department of Criminal Investigation, but not at the county level. So it really forced the hand, yeah.
And speaking of the DCI, do you have any sense that in this whole Walker cronyism affair, is that office staffed or perhaps stocked with a number of Walker cronies, operatives, or loyal Republican operatives?
It's possible. I mean, there are some very few appointed positions in the DCI, But the DCI is a sub-branch of the DOJ. It's the investigative unit for the Department of Justice. So it operates on orders from the Department of Justice, which would, of course, be the Attorney General. So, that office would not get involved unless it was instructed to do so by the Attorney General.
And pardon my ignorance on this. My pardon is to you and to the listeners. But under the Wisconsin Department of Justice, where does the Wisconsin State Patrol fall, and in particular the superintendent, I believe that's his official title, fall under that?
Well, they're not associated. The State Patrol falls under the Department of Transportation. So that would be under Secretary Gottlieb's purview, would be the Department of Transportation, which oversees the State Patrol. And that's a topic for we could do a whole show on on Stephen Fitzgerald and the State Patrol.
Okay. Then that sounds like we can do that in the near future, then.
We could. If anybody follows my blog this week, I have something that I've been working on regarding the State Patrol's role at the Capitol and the politicization of Stephen Fitzgerald's nomination. And
please,
appointment post.
For the sake of our out-of-state listeners and for those in-state listeners who may not necessarily be political aficionados of the process, please describe who Stephen Fitzgerald is and in relation to the positions that his two sons hold.
Oh, you just took the wind out of my sails. Yes, his two sons are Jeff and Scott Fitzgerald, the majority leader and speaker of the Senate and Assembly in the state of Wisconsin. So, and Stephen, their father, lost a bid to be elected Dodge County Sheriff in 2010, and he was subsequently appointed he was selected, is the official, for the superintendent's position in January, and in February, and he beat out, I believe it's five very, very highly qualified individuals, one of whom is the previous superintendent. So there's an interesting story of cronyism there.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. David Collins was the previous superintendent who reapplied for the position with the Walker administration and the new incoming DOT secretary, and he did not get the position. And I have all the resumes of the applicants, which people will be able to see this week when I get this posted, and they can decide for themselves who was qualified. So.
So you figure if, I suppose I should not make a snide remark, but both of the Fitzgerald boys, Jeff and Scott, have aspirations to take their policies, demeanor, to the U.S. Congress. One wants to be a Wisconsin state U.S. senator, and the other apparently has aspirations of becoming a U.S. congressman.
Sure.
Do you think then that they might find another opportunity for their father to continue the family political activity, some people would call political welfare, into the federal government? And whether he would wind up in, he did do a post as a U.S. Marshal for a while, Stephen Fitzgerald, as I understand.
Right. He was a Bush nominee for that position for the Western District of Wisconsin. He was the U.S. Marshal superintendent. And again, you talk about political appointments and cronyism and favoritism. I mean, honestly, his education level for what is normal for a U.S. Marshal is low. And, you know, the origin of a presidential political appointment is obviously in state political favor. So one can draw whatever conclusion they want, but it's interesting to note that the person he replaced in that office, I believe it's Daryl Nevins, was reappointed and approved at the outset of the Obama administration. So in 2010, we saw Daryl Nevins reassume the post of U.S. Marshal for the Western District, which he had held for, I believe it was 8 years prior to Stephen Fitzgerald coming in during the Bush administration. So,
during the Bush administration, Nevins wasn't sent to another post, perhaps in northern Alaska or anything to that effect.
No, not at all. No. So there's a lot of that goes on. But like you said, we could spend an entire show on that, and perhaps in the near future we will.
Sure. Sorry to digress, but we'll bring it back to the Walker John Doe investigation. So please continue.
Yeah. So then we come to the events of this past week, if you will, with Cynthia Archer. So we know who Cynthia Archer is. She was the Director of Administrative Services in Milwaukee County under Scott Walker. Now, I called the Milwaukee County Supervisor or County Executive's Office, Chris Abley, and they informed me that position no longer exists in Milwaukee County government, and in fact, prior to Scott Walker, it had not existed. So this was a position that Scott Walker created for Cynthia Archer in his administration. She was one of the point people in his administration in creating county budgets. So she had full knowledge and access to him as county executive and his policies. So after Walker left Milwaukee, you know, she assumed a position in the Department of Administration. She became the highest, one of the top appointees in the DOA. She was the deputy secretary in the department. And it's amazing that the Center for Media and Democracy obtained emails from her through Open Records. And it's very clear through these emails that she was the point person in pushing Act 10 through the legislature via the Department of Administration and actually helping to author parts of Act 10, which repealed the collective bargaining rights. So she was and is a significant person in his administration. And she subsequently left that job about a month and a half ago with virtually no notice and was reassigned to the Department of Children and Families into a position that she now makes $99,000 a year, which is a 65% increase over the previous person in that position. And she's been on sick leave since her appointment, and will not go back to work until early October.
Jeez, did she get a doctor's excuse?
That's not clear. Of course, that would not be public knowledge. You know, that would be private, being a personnel issue. But she's been seen in town. She's been at home. You know, she's made statements to the media. Obviously, she's not indisposed, but she has been on paid sick leave this entire time. And interestingly enough, just late last night, the Journal Sentinel broke a story that there was actually somebody interviewed for that position in Children and Families a week after Cynthia Archer was appointed to the position by the Walker administration. So the Department of Children and Families didn't even know that she had been named to this post, and they had interviewed somebody for that position. So here, this person who's so close to Scott Walker now has the FBI at her door. They take her hard drive, they go to a neighbor's house, and they take the hard drive of a computer that she sold to this neighbor during a rummage sale. And you also have Scott Walker, who back in March paid $60,000 retainer to Michael Besson Friedrich, to an attorney by the name of Steven Piskupic, who is an expert. He's a former attorney general for the Eastern District of Wisconsin, expert at white-collar crime, financial crime, and campaign fraud investigations. He's been on retainer in case the investigation gets too close to Scott Walker since March. So obviously, with Archer's removal from the DOA and put into this Department of Children and Families and being given an extended leave of absence, something's known by the Walker administration, and probably Scott Walker himself, to take those actions, reassign Cynthia Archer. So that kind of, that was the events, kind of leading up to then the story breaking yesterday about the immunity being granted by the former appeals court judge who is overseeing the John Doe investigation.
Well, then I have this question to wrap up the remaining few minutes, and that is, if I recall this correctly, and do correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds as though that a number of people that were granted immunity happened earlier in the year and almost before Walker was inaugurated.
Yes.
So it almost seems that his political efforts to take on all of the adverse political activity that he and the Republicans engaged in almost seem motivated by the potential blowout from this John Doe investigation.
I would agree with that. I would agree with that. There's immunity going back to December of last year for Roseanne Deek, who is a Republican operative in Milwaukee County, who, by the way, is a retired teacher. And I looked at campaign finance databases last night. She's a retired teacher who's donated over $7,000 to Scott Walker and Jeff Stone campaigns in the last 5 years. That's a lot of money for a retired teacher to be donating to a campaign fund.
Well, that's because she made what? She must have, as all the teachers did, she was using that $100,000 plus salary that she made. She had nothing to do. She couldn't find any other way to spend her money.
Sure. She had so much money being a teacher that she was able to give all that money to Scott Walker and Jeff Stone, who's also a Republican representative and ran for Milwaukee County Executive and lost. It's very close to Scott Walker, and it's very clear that, prior to him even being governor and inaugurated, he would have known the nature of this investigation. His own, spokesman, Cullen Wormley, has been granted immunity in the investigation. So this is getting very, very close to Scott Walker. And his actions, in hindsight, demonstrate clearly that there's some track covering going on. There is some stonewalling. And it is, considering who has been granted immunity and the players involved, it's probably only a matter of time before it gets to him. That would be my guess. And the obvious motive is this pay-for-play privatization, which is what he was pushing when he was county executive and part of his overall plan as governor. So,
well, let's go ahead and call that a wrap, and I would give you an opportunity to go ahead and make any future announcements or any other comments that you would like to present to the audience.
Well, you mentioned the website. It's badgerdemocracy.wordpress.com. It's Badger with no vowels, B-D-G-R, democracy, or you can just Google or Yahoo search Badger Democracy. Like I said, the Fitzgerald piece coming this week. I've been working on an extended piece for the Isthmus and Madison on Waukesha County politics, which will have some interesting insights, most likely seeing that fairly shortly. And I just published part five of the Scott Walker's Failed Wisconsin series, which is public education. That's up today with some interesting information about Elmbrook schools, New Berlin, Kaukauna, so fairly conservative places that are feeling the effects of Act 10, although you may not hear about it in the media. So,
all right. Well, great. Well, on that note, it's greatly appreciated that you appeared today on the Sarah Schultz Show. Look forward to hearing from you and speaking with you again in the near future.
Sounds good. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Scott. Have a great day.
You too. Thanks.
All right. Before we jump into our next segment, which is going to be In the Weeds, we're going to go to a news break, and then we will come back with our next guest, Mark Heffernan.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. On Thursday, President Obama, supported by labor and progressive groups coast to coast, pushed again for passage of his American Jobs Act and its $50 billion investment in repairing the nation's crumbling infrastructure. Unions and progressive groups rallied at bridges needing repair in at least 11 major cities. A new report from the Public Interest Research Group says 69,000 structurally deficient bridges are in urgent need of repair to make them safe. Lauren Wiener is with the progressive group United for Change.
We need to make sure that they're safe to drive on, and we need to make sure that we're putting Americans back to work, and we think this is a great way to do that.
AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka joined tens of thousands of California nurses and healthcare workers on picket lines Thursday at Kaiser Permanente. Their one-day strike protested moves by Kaiser and by Sutter Hospitals to cut health benefits, pensions, and patient services. Deanne McEwen is co-president of the California Nurses Association.
We're standing in solidarity with other workers on behalf of the patients in our community because these healthcare corporations are proposing vicious cuts to nurses' retirement security, healthcare coverage, and really encumbering our ability to make professional practice decisions that help keep our patients safe.
Striking Tacoma Washington Education Association teachers are expected back in their classrooms today after reaching a contract agreement that ended their strike. About 1,900 teachers went on strike September 13th over staffing issues, class sizes, and pay cuts. The striking teachers defied a court's back-to-work order and remained on the picket lines until a negotiated settlement was reached. President Obama's health care reform has made sure that 1 million uninsured young adults are now covered. Jesse Russell reports.
The Affordable Health Care for America Act is starting to see some measurable statistics. One of the most noticeable, and the one President Barack Obama will likely hang his hat on while seeking younger voters, is allowing young adults to stay on their parents' health plans until they turn 26. That piece of the legislation forced equality in how plans treated young adults, company by company, and state by state. The number of uninsured young adults between the ages of 19 and 25 declined by nearly 1 million in 3 months. While some Republican presidential candidates have been running on the message, repeal the whole bill, most Beltway insiders see that move as unlikely, as it would be unpopular to suddenly yank health care out from under the feet of these young adults. On Tuesday, Obama announced $109 million in grants would be split up between 29 states to assist in health insurer oversight. The grants are in tandem with new rules enacted under the Health Care Act requiring insurers to declare publicly the reasons for any premium increases above 10%.
This newscast made possible in part through underwriting from the OPEIU and the International Brotherhood of Boilermakers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org. Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Well, we're back. And we're going to be talking next with Mark Heffernan. And before we get to Mark, I want us to say that this segment is called In the Weeds. It is intended as a diversion from political commentary and discussion with a focus on the creative side of being human and being good citizens in our respective communities, our nation, and the world. All too often, we are inundated with information that is top-down, essentially coming from government, business, and academia, that creates the mindset that development is hierarchical, flowing down to the public. Well, the public, as most of us know, is smarter than what the mainstream media and elites would have us think. In fact, innovation has its many starts from people on farms and in urban garages experimenting with ideas using their own resources to develop things. So, to those things, we will be looking at aspects of renewable energy. So, our first guest today is Mr. Mark Heffernan. Mark is from Bioproducts Engineering Corporation and is a longtime investigator and developer of the two-phase method of anaerobic digestion for use in food waste conversion to energy. Mr. Heffernan, in collaboration with Will Allen and Growing Power in Milwaukee, has built and demonstrated at commercial scale the acid phase of the high solids two-phase anaerobic digestion process, and has demonstrated at laboratory scale the ability to use the high-strength acids from the acid phase to run a continuous flow methane digester. This demonstration gives validity to the notion that food waste can provide energy and assist in the year-round production of food in northern locations like Milwaukee, as cities work toward true sustainability to feed themselves even beyond the fossil fuel age. So, Mark, welcome. And as you begin your comments, I would ask that you incorporate a definition or description of what anaerobic digestion is for our listeners who may not fully understand the technology and the science.
Well, good morning, Bill. Thank you. The process of anaerobic digestion is simply the degradation of organic materials as they break down in the absence of oxygen. They give off methane gas. If those same organic materials were composted in the presence of oxygen, they would give off carbon dioxide and water. So the products of anaerobic digestion are carbon dioxide and methane, simply because the bacteria operate without the oxygen and produce methane. Most of the organic material that lends itself to processing through anaerobic digestion would be wet, sloppy food waste kinds of materials that come from the urban waste stream. And the stuff that lends itself to compost would be brush and limbs and Christmas trees and leaves and that kind of thing. And so, in fact, certain organic materials lend themselves to one form of processing or degradation versus another. So to obtain renewable energy from organic materials that are generated, the really wet, sloppy stuff is actually better suited to run in an anaerobic digester. So that's why food waste and sewage sludge and things like that are used as feedstocks for digesters, where dry pallets and wood waste and stuff like that would be combustible fuels and can actually produce energy that way. And some people are working on capturing heat energy off of the composting process itself, because compost does generate a fair amount of heat. So in the city environment, about 10% or more of the garbage is actually food waste. Taking that food waste, the vision that Will Allen had was that, well, heck, there's a lot of materials here that could, if it were allowed to degrade with an anaerobic process, could produce heat, and then we could use that heat in the wintertime to heat the greenhouse. The conventional way of doing anaerobic digestion doesn't actually work so great on food waste, and so we've been working on another method of doing food waste, what is called two-phase anaerobic digestion. The first phase produces acids. The second phase takes those acids and produces methane. In in the process of what we've been demonstrating, it has been such that we would like to produce a strong acid, which is not normally the case in anaerobic digestion, and then we can store and even ship those acids, and we can use them at a later point in time or at a different location in order to produce methane when and where we want it. So as that whole process relates to the work that Will Allen is doing at Growing Power, the sun and the heat from the sun is sufficient in the summertime, but not in the wintertime, yet in his vision of being able to grow food year-round, even this far north, the supplemental heat that would have to come from otherwise burning natural gas can be provided by producing that gas from the food waste that the city generates. And the city can generate that food waste year-round. We can capture the food waste year-round, produce acids most of the year, and then consume those acids during the time frame of the winter and heat the greenhouse. That's the plan for how to utilize food waste in a different way than a constant production of methane on a even during the summertime basis.
And if I may interrupt, where does the aspect of the term biomass renewable energy fall into the category, or is it a subcategory, of what you are describing as an anaerobic biodigester?
Well, biomass, I'm familiar with the term by using it, having it applied to virtually anything that's a biologically sourced raw material. So biomass can include food waste. It can also include the corn that they're using now for production of ethanol. It can include wood. It can include virtually anything that comes from a biological production of raw materials that then can eventually turn back into some kind of energy. Most of the biomass, if you understand the energy source of the planet being the sun, then biomass is actually stored solar energy and photovoltaics, and that kind of renewable energy capturing direct solar energy is just a different utility of the energy source, which is the sun. The stored solar energy in the form of biomass then is produced back into a usable form of energy for us in the various ways that the biomass itself exists. And dry biomass lends itself to a different method of conversion, so maybe burning, maybe conversion to ethanol for stuff that carries a lot of sugar in it, and then maybe even some of the residuals from an ethanol process, the protein, could then convert through an anaerobic digester. Some ethanol plants right now are using anaerobic digestion to capture or to convert some of the proteins that are left over from the ethanol process as they clean up their wastewaters, and then they can reuse the water at the same time they capture some energy back out of the discharge from the ethanol process. So biomass is a pretty large descriptor of various forms of energy that's basically stored solar energy in the biostrata. The work in trying to capture that in a synergistic way is, I think, one of the biggest difficulties with renewable energy, because renewable energy has, on each of the individual methods of capturing energy, had to prove itself on a standalone basis. But so much of the way Mother Nature works is that a piece of it should be anaerobic digestion, a piece of it can be combustion, a piece of it can be compost, a piece of it can be ethanol, and they need not all prove themselves on a standalone basis. And in fact, if the community really understands renewable energy in a more holistic fashion, cities would be building biomass energy facilities that had more than one method of capturing the energy built on the same site. So the ethanol plant would be producing liquid fuel from the sugars, but the discharge from that could then go to the digester, the discharge from that can go to the compost, and all of it would be built in an energy park funding all of that activity so that, and maybe even in that same energy park, is also where these multi-story greenhouses that Will Allen and others are envisioning are also located, because the standalone model of the economics of business in this country really doesn't help in terms of sustainability or in terms of environmental responsibility, because it leaves individual plants trying to reckon with what otherwise to them is a waste, but to somebody else is a resource. So as we look at the development of these technologies, we envision that this is just a piece of the puzzle, the part that we've worked out. But we started out as partners with Growing Power because Growing Power knew that the sun shines year-round. It may not be warm enough in the winter to grow food in a conventional greenhouse, but supplemental heat and the way that he does composting and capturing heat from the compost, those things combined, plus the solar energy that you get, you can grow food year-round. Then you can even take the food waste that comes from the city, put it back in the digester, and capture the nutrients from that, because they pass right through the digester, and the fertility for growing food need not come from far away, nor should the food actually come from far away from the cities that we're living in.
True.
So the sustainability model of all of this is actually something that concentrations of people living in things that we call cities should become much more self-sufficient, so that their food isn't coming from far away. The sun shines on every city. It doesn't give a dang. It's not as though sunshine and those kinds of energy systems can't be utilized in virtually every city on the planet. And a lot of what we see in the sustainability movement involves some far-thinking and visionary leaders of cities. I know that in Milwaukee, the mayor has intent to become become food self-sufficient, and that involves a lot of people working with lots of different methods. There's no one way of producing food. There's no one way of capturing energy. There's no one way of converting energy. And all of them combined together can give a city huge amounts of self-sufficiency once they start to pool resources and pool energies into development of processes that are synergistic with each other. The method of doing business that just leaves the residuals of the business as somebody else's concern is not something that makes sense going into the future, not if we're going to have an environmental and a sustainability consciousness about us as we also develop these renewable energy methods.
You know, if I was to ask you, to assess how the sustainability movement has been moving down a particular path, it appears to me that it is gaining momentum, but is perhaps not at a particular momentum where it should be. Could you comment on that and what is needed to perhaps accelerate that momentum? But I would also ask this, that what you have described is quite interesting. And I have two other guests that will be talking along similar subject matter. And if you would not mind staying on for the remainder of the show, I would like to bring on both of those guests, get them introduced, and then the three of you could have a dialogue that I think I would find, and perhaps others that are listening, to be quite educational. Would you be amenable to that?
Sure, I'll stay.
Okay. But then to the issue then of sustainability's momentum.
Well, I think that the momentum that we need to develop in the world of sustainability requires that we look at a lot of things that have influence on the behavior of people. If we've concentrated people in cities, but we haven't brought with us to those cities our own job creation and our own production of those things that we consume, then that's not a sustainable model. So having exported all these jobs in the face of profitability for the methods of thinking about what profit is and what progress is, lots of things have to change. Philosophically, they have to change. Structurally, they have to change. The built infrastructure has to change. The buildings themselves have to change. And all of that has to be something that we consider, that there, the predatory side of the behavioristic model that we have kind of inherited by way of our looking at what is economics has to also change, because the economic models that we follow that will allow people to think that there should and always has been winners and losers is a philosophical argument that can be had and needs to be understood, that in a sustainability model, Mother Nature has facets of all that gets done that's done by different entities, and all of them have value, all of them have responsibilities, and all of them pretty much meet those responsibilities. They get that work done. So whether you're looking at it bacteriologically or you're looking at it in terms of whole groups of species, the interaction between each other that we seem to think is something that's worthy of abandoning in the face of profit is not really a sustainable model. So as we look at how to build our cities into things that we want to be able to call sustainable, we actually have to change behavior, and we have to change the way we view ourselves and each other and our neighbors and our own inputs and our own responsibilities. One of those responsibilities that we seem not to get, which other people seem to get, because there's a mayor of a town in Brazil that absolutely got rid of all of what was there for hungry people, simply because she understood that there shouldn't be any hungry people in her town. Taking that on as a responsibility and just not accepting the fact that, oh, heck, there's always been hungry people, there's always going to be, she just didn't go along with that model, and now there are no hungry people in her town. These are the kinds of things that bring us to the place where sustainability actually can happen. Otherwise, it's just pie in the sky, and it's a bunch of people talking a lot of stuff that isn't really going to come true, because they're not necessarily dedicated to that. They may be more dedicated to sustainable profits for themselves, but that's not true sustainability.
Then that's great. That's an excellent segue then into my next guest, who is Greg David. And Greg David is a county supervisor and second chair of the Jefferson County, Wisconsin Board of Supervisors. Greg has over 30 years' involvement in environmental issues, culminating in his co-founding of the Natural Step-based group known as Sustain Jefferson. As part of Sustain Jefferson, Greg has been involved in pursuing alternative energy activities, such as developing a gasifier for residential and community use, and is now engaged in an effort to do the same with a biodigester, which has an intriguing name, but I will let Greg present that name and describe his latest farm urban garage activity. Greg, thanks for making yourself available. I would like you to describe how you came to establishing Sustain Jefferson and the renewable energy projects with which you have been involved. And I want to also be able to, after you, you know, describe what you have done, so that we can also have Mark engage a conversation with you, and then I'll be bringing on Charlie Hose within the next few minutes as well. So, Greg, take it away.
I disagree with you folks on one point, and that point is I don't think what we can do in the future can any longer be sustainable. I believe there's three ways to do something. Any process or product can be done exploitively, where we diminish the social capital and the ecological capital. It can be done sustainably, where we continue to hold an even keel with our social and ecological capital and assets. Or it can be done restoratively, and I believe really that's what the folks have been talking about, you folks have been talking about this morning, is learning how to do things so we are actually making the environment a better place to be, and so that we can extract interest from which we would run our society. And the social capital, all of our social and community assets need to be built up. So I'd like to think more in terms of restorative, where we are building those types of things. And that leads me then, Bill, to the point about Sustain Jefferson and our Jefferson County community-supported energy projects. Years ago, back when I was in high school, I came to the realization that we live on a finite planet and that continued growth to fuel our society and our economy was really a giant Ponzi scheme that one day was going to come to an end. And I spent over 40 years. Our first passively solar-built house was done back in 1975 and 6. And trying then to see, people didn't want to have anything to do with sustainability or restorative structures at that time because there was no imperative for it. We didn't know about this thing called peak oil, and we were living off all the fossil fuel, and we didn't understand that there was a real need for this. And to a good point, that condition still exists. People are denying the reality of diminishing resources, and an ever-expanding economy is not feasible on a finite planet. And so how do you reach out to people? And that was really the impetus behind Sustain Jefferson and our Jefferson County community-supported energy projects, is trying to put together some type of social structure where people that want to be involved and want to learn about these things have a place to go to where they can be educated deeply about what sustainability and restorative culture would look like and how they can do it in their own homes and in their own backyards. And the Jefferson County CSE group, the Community Supported Energy Group, takes that even a step further. And at our farm, where our laboratory and workshop is, we hold every Monday afternoon what we call gasifier therapy sessions. And we call it that affectionately because a group of us got together to build biomass gasifiers about 5 years ago. And since then, we've built anaerobic digesters and solar collectors and rocket stoves and top-lit updraft gasifiers and all sorts of home and shop-scale energy, renewable and restorative energy systems that can be incorporated into home and farm use. And I'm especially excited about our anaerobic digester right now because what it is, it's a very, 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 very simple and cheap style of anaerobic digester, which we, again, affectionately call the Bountiful Bowel. And that anaerobic digester is designed as the central heating plant for a greenhouse and or a home, whereby you have a thermal storage system where you can store heat from solar collectors, heat from burning your biogas, heat from burning any of the stoves and biomass digesters that we build. Store that energy, and then with simple tempering valves, keep the anaerobic digester at a comfortable 97 degrees. And once you have that type of infrastructure, you can use the excess heat to heat your house. You can use it to heat your greenhouse. You can set up these systems on very small-scale systems so that a person with 5 or 10 cows could heat their greenhouse or potentially their house. And in conjunction with that, if you are producing some type of burnable fuel, you really should be producing a higher grade of energy, electricity, and then capturing the heat from your internal combustion engine to make it a cogen plant where you're producing heat and electricity. So these are the types of projects that we're working on here and trying to involve people at a community level, at a grassroots level, to become engaged and come out to the farm and learn how to cut and weld and torch. It's a very simple, actually, it's a very simple makerspace program where people have an opportunity to learn hands-on skills as well as the more technical thermodynamic aspect of dealing with renewable and restorative energy systems.
Great. Greg, I have two questions for you. One, if you wouldn't mind letting our listeners know how they could get in touch with you and come out and see your farm, and also perhaps participate in the gasifier therapy sessions.
The easiest way is by email, Bill. My email is earthfirst@mac.com, and that is spelled earth1st@mac.com. And I check that all the time. And we do have a listserv, community-supported energy listserv, where we announce happenings and get into discussions about some of the subtler aspects of thermodynamics. But, yes, people are welcome to stop out to the farm Monday afternoon. And I would always call to confirm that we are having it because sometimes something comes up and we cancel therapy sessions for that day. but it's a fun thing to come to. It's an exciting thing to come to. We have such a collection of wisdom and know-how that assembles at these things. You can have a lot of problems solved just by coming to our grassroots experts and having them suggest opinions and options about your energy project.
Great. And then, Greg, Mark alluded to what suggests a paradigm shift in the way that we approach society, looking more toward a social benefit activities as opposed to a strictly profit-motivated activities. Now, I understand that your role on the Jefferson County Board, you have been successful in getting the county to, I want to say adopt, and correct me if that's the correct word, a sustainability committee, which I think has been a long time coming and really speaks to the forward-looking aspect of how Jefferson County's residents and its citizens, in spite of some differences, do look forward to the future. Could you comment on that?
Yes, we have been successful in getting a sustainability task force initiated to look into sustainability, and the task force is a three-step assignment or deliverables is some projects to implement, some short-term projects to implement, a long-term sustainability plan for the county, and an educational campaign so that people oftentimes when they deal with sustainability or what I would recall restorative culture oftentimes don't understand it. It's a very complex thing, and there's a reason for that. When we talk about trying to be sustainable or better, we have to think in terms of a holistic system. We cannot isolate our thinking on just one aspect of the systems around us, and typically that's our financial system. Yes, we need to be financially competent, and I think we do that, and I'm fiscally as conservative as almost anybody on the board. But I also understand that we have an energy budget and that we have a we need to have an ecological understanding so that we are not diminishing our future capacity to meet our needs by exploiting our environment. And toward that end, then, we need to educate our staff, we need to educate our officials, and we need to educate the general public so that they can come from an informed background and make informed, well-reasoned choices, as opposed to operating out of a vacuum and saying we can't do that because it's not important, not understanding peak oil, not understanding the energy, the ecological, and the economic crunches that we are coming to. We need to understand it deeply so that we can make, again, those well-informed, well-reasoned decisions. And that's what our task force then is about, is helping our county become more educated, setting a plan in place so that even if it's not implemented as quickly as I would like to see happen, at least it's there for future county board supervisors who are actually the policymakers and the staff have something to look at and understand so that they can move forward in a more restorative manner.
Great. And Greg, the point that you made about fiscal responsibility and even funding for these various projects is a topic that I think the three of you will be able to engage. And if you don't mind, then I'm going to jump to our third guest who I see has joined us. And that is Mr. Charlie Hose. And Charlie graduated as a double major in physics and renewable energy engineering. His career has been as a general building contractor and a system safety engineer, recently switching to renewable engineering and contracting for his retirement career. Charlie has spent many years as a product safety engineering consultant for the semiconductor equipment and manufacturing industry, and recently has done product safety engineering for large photovoltaic thin film manufacturing factories. Charlie will be discussing his recent findings on the efficiencies or lack thereof regarding wind energy. And once he's finished with his presentation, I would like then the three of you to join a conversation on issues that are relevant to what the three of you have discussed and to see where we can go with further educating not only myself, but our listeners as well. So, hello, Charlie.
Hello. Good morning. I guess it was by way of a little more introduction. Originally, I started my technical career expecting to get into renewable energy and alternative energy systems, but I got sidetracked with that system safety business, which I enjoyed for quite a few years, and have to confess I had my head down pretty much, not looking at what was going on around me from a renewable energy situation. Until I discovered, I live out in the country in Northern California with a beautiful view of the hills, of rolling grass-covered hills and things. And I found out that a company in Texas had leased 38,000 acres of land right directly in front of my office window to install a very large wind turbine power plant, which, of course, caught my attention. And I got my head up and decided I'd better find out a little bit more about what that actually meant, as well as my neighbors all of a sudden became alarmed that such a large industrial complex was going to be in our rural area. So the first thing that we kind of looked at was what were the environmental impacts of such a power plant. And it turns out that there are lots of them that I guess I knew about but didn't really appreciate how important they were. One is noise pollution. These things make quite a bit of noise. And what they actually do is make a lot of infrasonic noise, noise that's too low to hear but starts pulsing, and it really impacts people and their health, and it significantly degrades the pleasantness of the area. There's also what happened, because of the size of the installation and the size of these turbines, in order to get them there, there's a lot of, the area gets crisscrossed with access roads. It makes significant impacts to drainage and erosion. The whole area gets changed from the ecological point of view. And then there's these very large concrete foundations that get produced that are left there after they're decommissioned. These foundations go far enough that the drilling and blasting will disturb the underground water systems. Nobody knows how much or what, but it's just that we know that that'll happen. Of course, there's the view of these big things that are not exactly what I want to have in my front window. There's light pollution at night because they light them all up and they have things on them for airplanes and aircraft. They have large bird kills and bat kills. We're right in a flyway because we're in the central California valley, and there's a lot of birds and bats that fly north and south right through the valley, so there'll be a large kills of birds and bats. We are intending, this county is trying to make tourism and the rural atmosphere an ecological or an economic driver, and that will destroy that in this area because wind power plants really aren't a fit into the rural quiet community. It will probably change the local microclimates because of temperature, humidity, and wind speed and wind characteristics changes, which will change. Who knows what those impacts are? Anyway, there's a lot of, and actually the list continues on, of pretty serious environmental impacts associated with these very big, large wind power plants. So that was one, our initial assessment was, wow, this is going to be a significant impact. But then I wondered, is there really a reason for this? Is there some sort of, are they economically viable? Are they going to make money? Are they something that really, really need to get us into the off of energy dependency and help with global warming? The first thing I discovered when starting looking at rate schedules and power costs and electricity costs is that currently in California, the average residential electricity cost is about 24 cents a kilowatt hour. And for agriculture, it's about 12 cents. And for businesses, it's about 13 cents, about half of what the residential is. But with the wind power, it's going to have to increase to something in the neighborhood of 30 or so cents, or maybe even more. It could go to 35 cents. So what will happen is the introduction of power by wind power plants will increase the cost of electricity to people. And that, I don't know if that's really important or not. That's kind of a question, but I noticed that it isn't necessarily an economic boom to the community to have these power plants put in, because what's going to happen to the communities is they're going to have to pay more money for their power. So that got me looking into local alternatives, and then you've already talked about a lot of alternatives on this show, but one that I'm particularly fond of are local solar, what we call net metered. So that would be solar on houses and parking lots and photovoltaic type solar scattered around and put in where it's needed, so that there's no impact to the transmission systems. What you make on your roof is the power that you use generally. And it turns out that that costs about 15 cents a kilowatt hour right now, and the prices are dropping rapidly to do that. However, that 15 cents is what it costs the consumer to buy this power, as opposed to what right now he's paying is 24 cents for the same power. So this is almost a 9% or 9 cent per kilowatt hour decrease in the cost of his electricity. So there actually is a very big economic benefit for doing local solar as opposed to wind, which is a very negative impact. Then that kind of got me into, well, okay, maybe we just have to buck up, as they say, and go ahead and do it. Maybe there's enough benefit out of the wind from an environmental and global point of view that we have to do it anyway. And that got me into a really interesting bunch of studies. It turns out that because wind is very unpredictable and variable, the power plants have a hard time, not the power plants, the grid has a very hard time controlling the power on the grid with this unpredictable source. Typically, the grid has a load which is variable but predictable, so that during the day the load profile changes, and it changes that way normally. And the power plants that provide power to that grid can adjust their output to match that. And they can do it ahead of time. They know when it's coming. And there's a little bit of variability in the voltage allowed so that they can actually follow along. But with wind, if you put a large amount of wind into a system, now you have a large variability that is unpredictable. So all of a sudden, the grid will have great amounts of power from the wind, which means that they have to shut off their own power plants to match that, because you can't have extra power on the grid. There's no place for it to go. So those power plants have to drop their production. And then all of a sudden the wind will drop down, and then all those power plants have to turn back on again. So the power plants are running up and down trying to follow the unpredictable output from these wind generators. An extreme case that you can kind of think of is if you have, a stormy condition where the wind generators are producing a lot of power, meaning the power plants are running at their minimum amount because they can't to match that. And then if the wind speed goes up a little bit more, it can go above what the turbines can stand, in which case the turbines shut off. So all of a sudden the whole wind power plant turns off in one instant, requiring all of those idled or turned off backup power systems to have to turn on, and they can't do that. So those are situations where there's a large security issue that will probably bring the grid down when that happens. They've had that experience in other countries where the grid just couldn't handle that big of a variation that quickly. So what happens, in order to match this unpredictable and varying output, the power plants have to build special backup generating systems that are quick response, and they leave them running in what they call spinning reserves, so that the generators are running. They're not producing any power, but the engines are going, the turbines are going, they're using fuel, and then they can quickly adjust the amount of output. In that mode of operation, those power plants are very inefficient compared to what they would be if they ran in their normal, just constant baseline mode. So you end up losing efficiency from the power plants. And not only that, but because they're running inefficient, they make a large, much more emissions. These, they think that this would be okay with the penetration of wind of about 10%, so that about 10% of the power in the grid is made by wind. If it gets to be about 20%, it looks to be that it'll end up costing more energy to keep those windmills there, or wind turbines there, than it does if you didn't have them there at all. And it ends up that the emissions are may well be wiped out too. So what you end up with is a situation where you're running all these expensive wind turbines, but the backup is eating up the advantages that you have from the for global warming and oil use.
Well, then I'd like to interject and ask a question,
sure,
given our time. And thank you for all of that. And I'm going to ask this question, and then I would ask Mark and Greg for the two of you to, you know, come in and ask questions amongst each other, but after mine. And that is, with all of the talk about infrastructure, our collapsing infrastructure, do you see the need for a more efficient and electric grid that will actually accommodate newer types of technologies for electrical production? And have you heard any discussions within your network, or perhaps even within the state of California, that the government or businesses are looking to address this issue? And where would you see microgrids fitting into this scheme?
The answer is yes. They need to upgrade the grid, because even if you go to solar or PV or any other system that's variable, you're going to have the ability to be more flexible to match the variations. Wind is the worst, but regular solar has some problems too, so you have to do something about doing that. If you're going to go to wind power, then there's going to be a big need for more transmission lines, because the transmission lines have to be able to withstand, to hold the extra power when the windmills are being maximal efficient. If you go to local solar, you don't have to, because those transmission lines are already in place providing solar or providing energy to those houses and other facilities. So depending on how you implement your renewable energy, the amount of changes that have to happen to the infrastructure are quite dramatically different. Microgrids is an interesting kind of a topic. But, you know, if you did just on your house, it's almost like a microgrid. You make power right on your rooftop, and you use it in your house, so it never actually gets out onto the grid. You could have something in the way of a local community doing the same thing, so that the power is used and shared within a small area and never gets out onto the main grid. And therefore, you could do it in a much more cost-effective way. Normally, the power lines are already in place that would allow that kind of small-scale trading of power from one business into another, or between houses and things like that. Community power plants, for example.
Well, gentlemen, please feel free to engage a conversation.
One of the main things that we're going to need, in my way, in order to make all of this work, is we're going to have to come up with ways for storage. That's where we have a real deficit for electric power, particularly, is how do you store that? We've already talked about some of thermal storage, but there's a lot of other ways. Electric cars are thought of as maybe storage and batteries. There's hydraulic accumulators. There's a whole lot of technologies that are available to do it, but we haven't pushed that part yet. Okay.
Charlie and Greg, I want to tell both of you that I'm proud of the work that you do and that I appreciate the holistic thinking behind all of this, because the distributed power systems that you're talking about make so much more sense than a monopolistically controlled centralized power system, power grid. And the issues that you raise, Charlie, with regard to scale are extremely important, because if you get to a more locally controlled, locally produced system, the reliability goes up.
Yes.
The need for all of these monstrous standby systems goes down, and the cost goes down at the same time. But some of what we're talking about is also local control in terms of the political will to separate the monopolistic control of these power grids from those entities that control them and put that back into the hands of the local communities. In many places, hydro dams and local generating stations actually have gone belly up, or at least have gone out of production in lieu of this more monopolistically central controlled system. So a distributed power system also kind of takes into consideration a distributed power sharing system on the political side as well.
That's where the difficulty lies.
Yeah, I'm sure of that, because we've seen even utilities that now find themselves disinclined to take on additional producers or take on some sort of additional power production from local producers, or they just don't want to mess with the headaches of, or what to them consider to be headaches. But oftentimes, Emery Levins has pointed out a number of times that the mentality on these utilities has, they've actually forgotten that they're a public entity, that their public nature is what really should come first. So I think a lot of this is to really get back to what Greg was talking about with restorative systems.
Absolutely.
Bill, I have a couple of comments and thoughts on what we've just been talking about.
Go right ahead.
And three quick points. First, I agree that distributed power would be a wonderful way to do this. We have to start to have distributed power plants. And another quick point is biomass is a great way to store the sun's energy. Nature does it for us. And if we do it in an intelligent manner, we can actually have restorative ecological systems set in place that are capturing the solar energy. And what's the purpose of agriculture but to store sunlight and put it into a form that is useful for human beings? That's the primary purpose of agriculture. But bigger than all that is we need to look at these problems holistically and understand why there is such a demand for so much energy in our country and the worldwide. And if we understand what is driving the need for these things, we can certainly change our systems so that maybe you don't have to drive to work. Maybe you live right above where you work, or maybe you set up your systems where you can telecommute. And even beginning to think beyond that, our capitalistic system, capitalism is good. It's the best way to exchange goods and services amongst people. But we have drifted away from what I would call classical capitalism to neoclassical capitalism. And the focus of classical capitalism was to deliver products and service to the community and the people buying things. It was to take care of the people that were the workers. It was to meet the needs of people. Shareholder capitalism, on the other hand, is all about meeting the needs of the investor. And our stakeholder capitalism, capitalistic system, which we had 20 or 30 years ago, has slowly been transformed into a shareholder capitalism, where it's all about meeting the needs of the investor and let the rest of the system be damned. And it's having huge consequences. So we need to think mega, as Einstein said. We cannot solve these problems the same way they were created. We have to think like hugely bigger systems and more holistically if we're ever going to solve the type of problems that we've generated for ourselves.
Greg, could you speak a little bit more about your community-supported energy model, because that gets to that stakeholder thing that you're talking about?
Well, yes, Bill. Our community-supported energy group is just a group of good folks that meet almost once a week to work on projects that they think are important for their home, for their farm, for their community, and work at it on a grassroots level. So by bringing these different people together, we have a really dynamic exchange of information, of ideas, a real brain trust, if you will, coming together to help solve each other's problems, to give support, and to put in place, again, like a maker space where people can come and get ideas, have work done on their projects, and to build the social capital, the social infrastructure, if you will, where people create these little collective groups of people that are making change within their community. Once you come to a gasifier therapy session, you'll probably leave with a different understanding of how society operates, because we don't just discuss thermodynamics. We discuss politics and social structure and any number of things so that we can help people step beyond the current paradigm of living and step into a more restorative paradigm of living that we're going to have for the future. It sets in place that infrastructure build, a local infrastructure for change.
Well,
that's a very powerful model, Greg. I really appreciate what you guys are doing in the town of Viroqua, where there is a investor group getting started whose intent is simply to pool community monies to develop local businesses. That would be kind of a community-supported investor thing, similar to community-supported agriculture, similar to this community-supported energy. So it's really exciting to hear what you're doing. And to do it at the county level with the membership on the county board is even more powerful, because it takes a more visible stance in the political world and presents it as something that the community really needs to pay attention to.
I believe localization of much of what we do in the world is going to become absolutely not only key to what we're doing, but it's going to become the only way we can do things, because as we reach this phenomenon known as peak oil, and most scientists will argue that we have reached peak oil, and it's, if everybody doesn't understand peak oil, it's a concept that you need to understand, and this peak phenomenon occurs with all our natural resources. It doesn't mean that we're going to run out. What it means is we can no longer extract that resource any faster than we have now, because when we extract any resource, we always extract the low-hanging fruit first, and then it gets harder and harder. Now we have to drill through a mile or two of ocean and through a mile of crust or up on the north slopes or in people's sands who don't like us very much, and it becomes more and more expensive. And finally, there is an energy return on energy invested. And when we started harvesting oil, it was 100 to 1. You put one barrel of energy in, you got 100 barrels out. Now it's approximately 10 to 1. The tar sands, I would argue, doesn't even break even, and it costs more energy than what you're getting out of the ground. And it's only through huge subsidies, both environmental and social, that the whole system is continuing to work. But at some point, it becomes irrelevant if the oil is down there, because we won't have enough energy to extract the oil back out of the ground. And before we reach that time, we have to transition to a more restorative type of ecological and social system, or we are doomed, quite frankly.
Well, gentlemen, any last comments?
My last comment is all of this, I agree, it has to be done at a local level, and I think the county is probably a good size to do that, and that's probably where our effort should be going if we're going to go any places, to try to influence the county board of supervisors and planning commissions and local investments.
And I would like to add to that that what I see you doing, Greg, and what you're talking about, Charlie, with regard to local solar, is that virtually none of these alternative energy systems are standalone and capable of providing, even when we think about cutting back our own energy consumption. Each of these renewable energy methods is worthy of consideration for financing and developing to their maximum, because on the combined basis, each of them contributing their piece, then we have a much more synergistic and a much more appropriate method of capturing the solar energy that we're
right.
given every
well,
day.
Solar energy needs to be backed up with something for nighttime. So
yes.
Other renewables are necessary for that.
Yep, yep.
For example.
Well, heck, it'll build a much stronger community, too.
Yes.
Well, gentlemen,
yes, exactly.
On that note, we are 50 seconds away from the show's end, so I want to thank the three of you for participating. It sounds like this was a great conversation, and I think we might have the opportunity to do this again, and hopefully you'll provide me the opportunity to contact you and carry this conversation forth.
It was good. Thank you.
Sounds good to me. Thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity, Bill.
You are all welcome. So great, and have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank
We're
you
proud of you, too, Bill.
Thank you.
So, ladies and gentlemen, just in closing, I want to thank all of my guests for volunteering to appear today, as well as thanking all of you for listening into the Sarah Schultz Show. Remember that Sarah Schultz Show will be at the new time on Friday, starting next week, Friday, September 30th, from 9 to 11 a.m. Thanks to all, and remember to keep up the good fight, as democracy requires your personal attention and involvement. And do not abdicate this experience to someone else. Thanks and have a great day.